All right, how's everybody doing? It is 6 o'clock here in Chicago, and welcome to Chicago Music Revealed, Chicago Jazz Magazine, chicagojazz.com. I am Mike Jeffers. Welcome to Wednesday. We made it to Wednesday. This is episode 37. Now, yesterday we had quite an interview. If you missed it, you need to check it out. It's on chicagomusicrevealed.com. We are lucky enough to tie down and talk with Bear Williams, bassist extraordinaire. As you know, he played with George Duke for 20 years, Anita Baker. The list goes on and on and on and on. So if you didn't catch the show yesterday, I encourage everybody to head over and check it out. But not until this show is over right now, because we've also got another incredible guest today. J.D. Walter is on the show. We're going to talk about brand recording Dressed in a Song, which is just came out a couple of months ago. And we've got a lot to talk to him about. He actually did this recording with 6 different piano players on the recording. Conceptually, it sounds wonderful. It's each tune is different. So we'll talk all about that with JD in one moment. I wanted to make sure everybody also knew to visit epiphanyshy.com. Of course, I'm not only the founder of Chicago Jazz Magazine, chicagojazz.com, and Chicago Music Revealed, but also I'm the director of programming and entertainment at the Epiphany Center for the Arts, right there at 201 South Ashland Avenue, opening soon. So visit epiphanyshy.com and sign up on the mailing list, visit the websites, all that good stuff. Also, all the social media. And as I always say, when it comes to this show, if you like what you're hearing, please leave us a comment. Please give us a like. Please share this out. It means a lot. This show is picking up steam. We're getting a lot of views after the show, which is exciting, but also the podcast is on fire. So if you don't watch it here, you can download it, subscribe to the podcast, chicagoaudioexperience.com, and much more. So without further ado, I want to bring up J.D. Walters. He is here. He's got a brand new recording. J.D., how are you?
I'm great. Thank you. Pleasure.
Well, it's great to have you on the show. I have not had a lot of vocalists on the show, so it's great to have you on the show, and especially since you came out with this unique recording called Dressed in a Song. And you came up with the concept of doing a recording with 6 different piano players on the recording. Am I right about that, right? There's 6 different piano players. I thought
there
I counted.
There are 6 different pianists, yes.
Okay. So it was interesting to me because usually that's difficult, right, to get a vibe on a recording and have that same vibe kind of work throughout a recording when you're mixing in different instrumentalists, specifically piano players, and you're doing duo tunes with most of them. I think there's one trio track on there. But,
right,
you know, talk a little bit about the concept and why you ended up deciding so many different piano players rather than just sticking with one and coming out with one recording with that concept.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. So, yeah, I mean, Kurt, we were talking about before the show started that of course, Kurt Elling hails from Chicago. And we're good friends, and so this album coming out at the same time he was coming out that he had a project that he was with Danilo, and so you know, there's a one pianist, one vocal, but my project I had conceived of, I mean, it wasn't to be unique for unique's sake, but I had seen a number of records, maybe it was Herbie Hancock, a number of people who have made a record where they have a different on each track, something out a different pianist on each track.
Mm-hmm.
And especially I've had so many great relationships with piano players. It was an homage to many of them, to have them all in one place. I've often thought of putting a record together of past records with select tunes with different pianists on it, because I've just been so blessed to have played with so many great talented pianists. And so then I said, why not make a record? And then for a while I had a list on my wall. I had like Jerry Allen's name. She passed away during the process. I mean, it was Jerry Allen. There were a number of pianists that I had on a list, wish list of people that I didn't play with regularly, but most of the people on the record were very familiar to me that I've known over 20 years.
Well, and they're very familiar to a lot of people that are listening as well, because they're all really well-known piano players. So why don't you talk a little bit about the different artists that you played with and talk a little bit about the tunes and how you came up with the selection of them, because I think you composed some, and then there's some standards on there, or some cover tunes, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly. I kind of went through them all. So
Yeah, so I believe I have three original recordings, or three original songs on the record. One is another song that's from the hymn book, as it were. Two covers, three covers, if you will. One is What the World Needs Now, which is very applicable now, of course. Didn't plan on it. And then an old weather report tune. I think it's one of the tunes that they ever had a singer. That's Can It Be Done? And then I do an arrangement of a standard. So it's however many songs that is. And then that's six songs and then a seventh song that has all six pianists on it, I believe. I called them in one at a time, of course. They played their song. We recorded it. And then with a click track, I made a ghost track singing along with them. They played an intro. We played so many choruses. And then I had on the screen all these pianists lined up. And I had to, it was like a puzzle. It was a very geeky thing to do. You know, how can I piece them all together? Because sometimes I had up to three piano players playing at the same time. And so that was, what registers are they playing in? And I'm checking out their registers and who's more active and who's more subdued and pairing them up. And so it was a fun, geeky thing for a musician to do as well. Like, you know, it was a puzzle.
That sounds way more technical than I would ever want to do. You know, I play drums and that's, I'm out at that point. I say, all right, you guys do whatever you want. I'm going to get a coffee. I'll be back. So, it's interesting to me too. I mean, listening to the recording, and we should also talk about who helped produce this recording, because I mean, he's a Grammy winning producer. And was he somebody that came up with some of these ideas, maybe for repertoire for specific piano players, or even that whole thing that you just did there that you're talking about, right, having all the different piano players?
I actually brought Al Pryor on the back end of this recording. I had started the recording a few years ago and then ran into some health issues where I hadn't been feeling well. Mm-hmm. And then I had 1 year of touring where I was just out so much. I think I did at one tour was 31 days and six time zones, 30 concerts in 31 days.
Oh, man.
In six time zones, followed by, you know, flying to another country, playing with a loud fusion band, followed by flying to another country with a 10-hour days in a recording studio. I came back. My voice was bothering me. Had it checked out. Sure enough, I've got a polyp. Not terrible, but needs to be taken care of. I'm on the operating table. They're ready to take me in. Anesthesiologist says something's wrong with your heart. I had this. So I had to get all these things taken care of. Subsequently, couldn't travel. But I had already started the recording. And now I can't finish it. Now, when I go back to finish it, I bring Al Pryor, mm-hmm. who I had met and had known for years because I sang, I think, four songs on a Sean Jones record called Kaleidoscope.
Oh, okay.
Sean Jones, a trumpet player.
Sure.
And Al was head of A&R at Mac Avenue, which Sean was with. And so I met Al on that record because Sean asked if he could perform and if I could perform with him an original song of mine, an arrangement that I had written, and a couple songs he wanted to do. And Al said, I want to work together. I want to work together. And now finally I had a chance. So I called him up to help me out in the back end of this record. How am I going to finish this thing up? And so he's instrumental. And actually now he's with the management team that I'm working with. And so we're just great friends, you know. Mm-hmm. And of course he won, was it last year or the year before? He won Grammy for Cecile McLaurin's record.
Right.
So he's
right.
A great producer. He's won a few other Grammys as well, but he's a great guy and he's a great producer. So,
you know, sometimes it's really important, and it's interesting to me too, because we should talk about this a little bit, because there's a lot of musicians, a lot of younger musicians, established musicians that watch and listen to this show. But, you know, it's important to have a really good producer. And especially the way Al came in on this, it seems like he came in at the end, but really helped push this thing forward and probably gave you some pointers and listened to it as kind of just an outside, putting some ears on it, which probably helped a lot in the post-production and putting things together, especially something like this, right? What's the importance that you feel like what a producer can add to a recording?
Well, I mean, what's the saying? A lawyer who represents himself has a fool for a client. I think, you know, right. A musician who produces themselves sometimes has a fool for a client type of thing. That second set of ears is great. You know, people, a lot of musicians have less than positive things to say about producers sometimes. And some of it's founded, some of it's not founded. But Al was great, and I loved working with him. And I was really headstrong early in my career, so I recorded and produced at least my first record by myself and a few others, and to some success. And so I thought, I got this, but eventually learned, look, it's better to have that second set of ears, and which is giving you direction and at least getting ideas off of, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, well, and I also brought that up, especially with somebody like you. I mean, reading over your bio, I mean, you're at over 100 recordings, it says. And I mean, you've played all around the world. You've toured. You've played with so many different groups and everything. And, you know, it's interesting to get a perspective from somebody that's done that much. And then they are still like, yeah, I need to have a producer because I need that second set of ears. I need to have that little extra input. And that's really, I think, you know, as a musician myself, that if you're open and you're open to bringing in that information and taking it in, it helps push you to that next level too. It's almost like having a coach in football, right? It pushes you to that next level and you say,
sure,
you know what? That's right. But you have to be really comfortable with the person you're working with, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think actually it was a conversation I was having with Kurt, and he says, I'm not even really sure what a producer does. You know, he says, I think they just kind of pick songs and they just say, do that and you do it. And that, and I said, and of course he wasn't serious.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, sometimes you get that vibe from, you know, and you hear the stories about the band that goes into the studio and they record a take. And then the producer says, we're going to try something else. And after a couple hours, it comes back to the original take.
Right.
You know, that type of thing. But I mean, there's some great producers out there, you know.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, we're here with J.D. Walter. Of course, this is Chicago Jazz. Chicago Music Revealed on Chicago Jazz Magazine. I'm Mike Jeffers. We're talking about his brand new recording, Dressed in a Song. And let's talk a little bit about your background in voice and music specifically. But, you know, as we talked before we came on, and you and I talked a little bit about Kurt, because he came out of Chicago, obviously, but he's one of those vocalists I love, and I love listening to, and I love the way that he uses his voice as an instrument. And when I was listening to your works, not just on this recording, but I went back into YouTube and listening to stuff, I mean, you really have your own sound as well, but it really seems like you approach being a vocalist as another instrument, especially when you're working with a trio, working with a band. You're in there, and from a musician standpoint, I love that, because you can just feel the fact that you're working with the band, you're playing off of what the rhythm section's doing, you're interpreting the song a certain way, and it's your way. How did you develop that style? I mean, was that a conscious effort, or is it just something naturally, organically just came through you when you started singing originally?
Well, we talked about this. We both went to North Texas.
Right, right.
Well, when I was down there, they didn't have a vocal jazz major. And so I was a double concentration, percussion and vocal. I was percussion, jazz studies, and vocal ed, performance for a while, and then I was ed, education. Mm-hmm. And then Neil Slater and Paris Rutherford and Steinel and whoever else came up to me and said, hey, Dan Hurley, yep, we want to talk to you. Would you be interested in piloting the first vocal jazz degree at the school? And I said, well, sure, that'd be great, you know. And I said, what does that entail? And they said, one-on-one classes. And I was like, ooh, I guess I can't sit in the back and, you know, goof off. And so it was a rude awakening, because there were no other vocalists in the program. I was taking all the performance classes with instrumentalists.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes it was embarrassing because the learning curve was so great. At first for me, until I kind of found my bearings and figured out how to kind of catch up. Another thing Dan Hurley had said to me, because, you know, small group was a class we had to take. So basically this is where you get involved in three horn chart arranging. And he said, all right, he didn't, you know, nobody wants singers involved in their classes as far as performance. You know, it's pulling them back. And oftentimes it's true. It needs to be handled very delicately. And he says, He says, all right, you're going to be in small group. Just don't be doing the singer stuff so much. And I said, all right, all right. So everything I wrote, I was just a horn, you know?
Yeah.
And that's how it was. And so I finished, and this was something we talked pre-interview,
mm-hmm.
About me having gone to Amsterdam. I don't want to preempt your
no,
question,
no. Yeah. I mean, we were talking a little bit pre-interview, but I think it's fascinating. So keep going.
Yeah, so I'm at North Texas, and even though I studied with Paris Rutherford, I studied arranging, I studied, you know, with, as I said, Steinel, and who else was I studying with? Fred Hamilton for improv, which totally kicked my butt and was a complete inspiration. I had never studied with a jazz singer.
No kidding.
So here I am, you know.
Yeah.
I'm at North Texas, there's no teachers, there's no vocal jazz teachers.
That's right.
So all I did study improv and arranging with the rest of the instrumentalists. So we were at IAJE, the International Association of Jazz Educators Convention in New Orleans, one of my last years at the school, and I heard a singer there. Her name's Deborah Brown. And I said, wow, you're amazing. Where do you live? I'm going to come study with you. She says, I'm from Kansas City. I said, great, I'm moving to Kansas City. She said, no, I'm living in Amsterdam right now. And I said, well, give me an extra couple months. I'm selling everything I own, which I did, and I moved to Amsterdam, and I studied with her for about eight or nine months intensively.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So it's interesting, though, because you actually had that improvisational instruction at North Texas with some of the masters in improvisation, right?
Like nobody's business. I could improvise like nobody's business, but I couldn't really interpret a song so well.
Oh.
And Deborah said to me one day, you know, we were talking about certain singers, and she said, you need to check out this singer, this singer, this singer. I said, oh, I don't really care for that singer. Their voice is wimpy and blah, blah, blah. And she said, oh, but he means what he says and you don't. So it's like, I'm like, oh, okay. You know? So she was not mincing any words with me. I needed to study singers.
Yeah.
And, cause I was studying players. I was transcribing like nobody's business. I was approaching it very instrumentally, and I needed to get away from that and find my own voice as a singer. So that's what she was great for, you know,
so
working with her.
Did you find like when you're doing the improvisational stuff and then you start studying with Deborah, all your breathing and everything was probably still there. I mean, it was there. It wasn't necessarily that. It was more about the interpretation of the song, or did you actually have to go and did she have certain exercises you had to learn about and redo kind of the way you sang actually because of,
well,
you know,
I think one of the inherent problems of all jazz education is there are some things that are neglected. The emotional vantage point of things. For instance, one of the exercises I have my students do when we're dealing with improvisation is I'll say, all right, can you play happy over these changes? Fine, no problem. Can you play sad over these changes? Fine, no problem. Can you play jealous over these changes? And they're like, what? Jealous? What does jealous sound like? Oh. I said, well, you just played happy and sad. So, and what were you thinking about when you were doing that? So my point is that oftentimes the emotional intent behind what we're doing is not taught as instrumentalists. And we're taught, it's a very testosterone infested thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, the faster, the very licky, the whatever it is, versus maybe more expective vocal approach to things, which, man, when you study the great instrumentalists, they have that anyway, you know.
Right.
So it's almost like a magic key that turned on that she handed me, where she said, you need to approach and investigate emotional content versus... you know, it's better to feel good rhythmically and have emotional content behind what you're doing rather than all of this, gymnastics that you're doing right now, you know,
that's really interesting. And I would imagine that just had to blow your mind when you started thinking about it that way. You had to really re-examine what was happening. You know, I mean,
mm-hmm.
I can remember actually, I attended one of those Jamie Ebersole camps way back in the day, and I forget who the vocalist was, but he was running a combo that I was in for a second, and he made us all learn the lyrics to some tune, and I can't remember what it was now, and really understand what it was, and then play it down after we like analyzed it and understood what the story was behind it, then go back and play the tune with that emotion. And it was a completely different emotion than what I was playing it as and anybody was playing it as, because we were just playing the melody, playing the head down and all that stuff.
Right.
That had to really, that's like had to be eye-opening to you when you started thinking about all of this stuff that way.
It was dumbfounding to me. It was like, oh my God, it's a whole other world that I have to reckon with. I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about what we do, Mike, is that, you know, ideally, it doesn't, there's not an end to our quest.
Right.
You know, so it was just, but it was a big, whoa, that's a heavy bag that needs to be opened and addressed, you know.
Now, you know, also compositional wise, because, you know, it's always fascinating to me writing the music, but then the lyrics and writing lyrics. I mean, is that something that you came natural to you? Because I'm always curious when I talk to somebody who actually writes original compositions and writes lyrics to them, because I think that's almost harder than writing melodies a lot of times. It's putting those lyrics together and telling the story in a fashion that makes sense musically.
I mean, that's a craft that while I enjoy doing it, I'm not a master at it, but I like to do it very much and have been doing it for a while. Got into poetry in high school to some degree. And then while at North Texas, after I got back to the United States, because I came back to Denton, to the North Texas area after studying with Deborah, I was sick of jazz and started singing in a rock and roll band. And this was my first foray into really writing a lot of lyrics that I was performing. And it was one of the best, most musical and growth experiences that I've had in my life, having the confidence to see what you're writing manifest itself on stage almost, you know, within a week or 2 weeks you're playing on stage. So, you know, and that was one thing. And then there was another thing at North Texas. I had an English composition class where we'd come into the classroom and the teacher, this is right at the advent of computers. I mean, the internet wasn't around then,
right.
But there were computers there, the green screen, whatever. and the teacher would say, okay, what you're going to do is you're going to write for the next hour. And you can't stop typing. I'm like, what are you talking about? If you have nothing to say, then you have to type. I have nothing to say. I have nothing to say, or whatever it is. And, well, you did that a few times. And then you said, you know, that's ridiculous. I'm just going to keep on typing a story. So you would write continually for an hour. And at the end of that hour, you would have a large body that you could revise.
Yeah.
And so kind of a philosophy that I have in writing is write, revise. And I continued on with the lyric things till it's, you know, the title track of that record, Dressed in a Song. I mean, I was down to one word that I wasn't happy with, and that song wasn't going to be done until that word was found, you know. And on top of it was for my mother. You know, I wrote that song for my mother. So I'm like, it was written for her 80th birthday. So I'm like, this has got to be right. I can't. And then it turned out to be a popular song from the record, and it's doing well. And so I made some right moves in being very, very discerning about lyrics. So
what's the meaning behind that, Dressed in a Song?
So I was adopted before the age of one, and my father was ex-military. He was a lawyer and then a criminal court judge. My mom and my dad were opposite ends of the spectrum. He was very strict, and she was not that he wasn't loving, but he very military, you know,
right.
The shoes shined, the bed, you know, the everything, and learned the military jargon, you know, but my mom was a great musician, and she played piano, and she sang, and she was a music educator. So from age 4, 5, 6, she started teaching me. And so the song Dressed in a Song, title track to that record, came from, I was given a second chance, as it were, in life. And love came dressed in a song. You know, she taught me music. She taught me. And so there it was. And there's a title track.
Oh, that's awesome. That's a great story. That's a great meaning behind the whole thing. We're talking to JD Walter here, his brand new recording, speaking of what we're talking about, Dressed in a Song. It's available at jdwalter.com. We're going to link everything up, obviously, below. And before we wrap this entire thing up, I'm always curious. When you left North Texas, I'm assuming you went to New York, did you start? How did you? It's always interesting to me because, you know, you hear instrumentalists one side, but with a vocalist, especially a jazz vocalist, I mean, that's a hard business to break into and start to establish yourself, and then going to New York. So, I mean, what was the first, your first success, I should say, like when you're like, okay, you know what, I can actually do this professionally here in New York and have this be my career being a jazz vocalist?
Well, as I said, after I came back from to North Texas and was singing with the rock band, it gave me this immense amount of, which eventually broke up and I went back to singing jazz. You know, I needed to eat and I was tired of donating blood. I'm back jazz again, and I felt confident. You know, North Texas, they put you through the ringer, and yeah, if you get through it, you know, you got something, you know. So, and everyone, they call it the Little Apple. I know Jim Riggs used to call it the Little Apple, but everyone was moving to New York. A lot of people moved to New York after North Texas. I did not move there immediately. I moved back to outside of Philly, where my family's from. And I lived there and started booking clubs and working my way into playing, going to jam sessions in New York, mm-hmm, and playing gigs now and again in New York. And then from booking clubs, bringing people from New York to me. And I recorded my first record with Greg Hutchinson and John Swann and Jean-Michel Pilk, mm-hmm, in the mid-90s. And then immediately after that, started working with Ari Honig and Jean-Michel in a band, and Francois Mouton and Steve Varner and John Swann. And even before I moved to New York in the late 90s, I was already working with Dave Liebman.
Sure.
I know you had Lydia on, her father. I had taught her some voice lessons when she was about 8 years old. but I started working with Dave. And so the transition to New York was a lot easier because I had just finished that record. And I already put out a record and was working with some heavyweights in New York. So the transition was a lot easier, I think, than most. But, you know, the great thing about North Texas or Berkeley or another heavy music school is when you move to New York, it's connections, it's connections.
Right.
It's who you know. So I knew a lot of people here already.
I think that's an important point to say, too, because, you know, you always hear, and there's, especially nowadays, I mean, you and I were at North Texas just about around the same time. I was there a year after you left. But that whole scene down there was just like, it was insane when you start actually thinking about who was there and who you were playing with and how many people were there and then where they all went and what they all ended up doing. But knowing people and then like what you did, going to Philly and then going in and out of New York and connecting with those people and playing with people, you can do a lot of that now. But back then it was a little more difficult. You can do a lot of that now in Chicago too. Back then it was a lot more difficult, but connecting and creating those relationships where you feel comfortable so you're not going in totally cold. And then when you go in to New York and you're in a situation like that, you're around people you're comfortable with and there's work to be had because you kind of know the scene. You got the lay of the land a little bit before you walked right into it. And I got to believe that's one of those things that I think a lot of people sometimes when they move straight to New York as a musician straight out of college because they think it's a good idea, I think they get shocked right away and say, whoa, wait a minute. And then they end up either transitioning back to where they came from and then maybe come back a little bit later. It's that connection thing and learning about stuff. I mean, that's the main thing, I think, when you throw yourself into such a professional atmosphere.
Right. I wanted to be ready.
Yeah. Know. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, this has been great, man. Congratulations on the new recording, Dressed in a Song.
Thanks so much.
I appreciate you taking a few minutes. And hopefully, you know, how are you hanging out during this COVID-19 situation? I mean, there's nothing happening. Are you doing some online things? Are you recording? Or are you just trying to make it through with what's happening and hoping everything opens up soon?
Mike, I tell you what, you know, sometimes it seems like I'm busier now that this is all going on than before. I mean, certainly it's an opportunity to catch up on all the busy work we wish we have time to, as far as shoring up our our business aspects of things, whether it's, you know, making sure things are copyrighted, making sure, you know, all the things are connected. And I've been doing a lot of free teaching to countries, different countries around the world. I did Russia twice with 100 students each time. I did Italy. Wow. I did Spain. I did Germany. I did the United States and Canada. I'm planning to do one in Japan free, because people are suffering and musicians are suffering. And so, you know, just giving. I think a lot of musicians are giving as well as being in need. They're also giving of themselves as well.
Yeah. You know? Oh, that's amazing. So they're free classes. So you're just connect with an educational institution or something somewhere.
Well, I connect with them and they advertise, but I mean, I even called North Texas and said, I'll give free lessons to any of the students down there. I said the same thing to a conservatory where I teach in Europe. You know, I'll give free lessons. And because I know the students are also frustrated too. They're in school. They're like, this is our education. This is my senior year.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, man, I love North Texas. I love my alma mater. So anything I could do for that. And then also some institutions where I teach around the world, you know, like, hey, let me help out. Let me just give some freebies here, you know?
Oh, that's amazing, man. Congratulations on that too. That's awesome. That, you know, I feel like this time, it's kind of like a great pause, right? And like what you said, you can catch up on a lot of stuff. I think a lot of musicians that you and I probably both know have learned a little bit more about technology as far as streaming, as far as social media, as far as connecting with a larger audience, all of that stuff. They're figuring out those online lessons, things and everything. But I also think that creative spark when we come out of this whole thing, people like you you're giving back. I mean, that's the whole purpose of this whole thing, is figure out how we can all get through this whole thing. So when we get out of it, we're all better on the other side. And I love the fact that you're doing that for free and giving back like that, because who knows who you're touching. You might all of a sudden spark one of the world's greatest vocalists here in the next 10 years because you gave them a free lesson and they were in Russia and they came to the United States and they blew up. I mean, so that's incredible.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the information's not mine, you know. I got it, and I'm happy to share it, you know.
Yeah. So. Well, congratulations. Congratulations on the new recording, Dressed in a Song. I am glad that we're finally connected here. You can pick up all the information at jdwalter.com, and I'm sure all the social media platforms have you up and around down there as well, where they can connect with you. And hopefully we'll get to meet in person here in Chicago at some point when you're performing somewhere, and hopefully that's sooner rather than later.
Sounds good, Mike. Thanks so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. And I've been checking out your archive and what great interviews that you have and great people on your show. I've been digging it quite a bit.
Oh, man. Well, I appreciate that so much. Hopefully we'll have you back on sometime very soon.
Sounds good.
Awesome.
Sounds good.
Thanks, JD. Take care.
All right. Take care. All right. Be safe.
JD Walter, sorry about that. It's always, I've got to get used to changing off of Skype and then changing back on. But anyways, what a great interview. What a great guy. Incredible recording. I encourage everybody to go check that out. But he's got a lot of other recordings up on his website. So jdwalter.com. You know, went to North Texas. I went to North Texas. So that's always a good thing too, right? But I mean, I love the fact that he's giving back in those free lessons. And I'll tell you, if you are a fan of vocal jazz or just vocalists in general, and you haven't become familiar with JD Walter, you need to become familiar with JD Walter. I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised. He's got his own voice. He's got his own sound. And that's very unusual for vocalists to be able to find their own sound in this day and age. So I encourage everybody to go check that out and hit him up. Say hi to him. Tell him if you like the recording and hopefully purchase it. That's always good. That's a great way to support any artist in this day and age right now during this entire COVID-19, is purchase something, buy some music, buy some merch, and connect with them. Even if you just sign up on their email list so you can stay connected, so when they come through your town, you can visit them and see them live. That's a big plus. That's a great way to support and help people out in the arts, no matter what arts. Actually, I should just, outside of music, any of the arts. If you go buy a painting, go buy a photograph, anything like that, it's going to help the artist right now, because nothing's happening in the art world right now. And it's tough. And I've talked to a lot of musicians. So I encourage everybody to do that. Thanks again to JD Walter for being on the show. And of course, thanks to Lydia Liebman, who helped to set that whole thing up, man. She is a rock star, and I appreciate her helping and her support of this program. Episode 37, man. All right, we're cranking along. All right, so episode 38, which is tomorrow, we're going to have two special guests. We're going to have Brett Dean from the Shout Section Big Band, and Wayne Powers is going to be on, and we're going to be talking about a new track that they're going to be putting it out on Saturday as part of an International Jazz Day explosion or something, social media thing. They're going to tell us all about it. I got a little bit of information from him when I was talking to him yesterday. I'm excited he's going to be on the show, so that's going to be fun. And then on Friday, Petra Van Nous, another great vocalist, a Chicago vocalist, she's going to be on, and her and her husband, Andy Brown, who I'm sure a lot of people in Chicago are very familiar with, both of them. They'll be on Friday talking about their live streams, talking about all of the different things they've had to do to keep solvent during this COVID-19 situation, and a whole lot more. Also, red alert, June 5th, we are going to be having a bass summit. We're going to have five or six bass players on here at one time, which should be interesting, which is going to test my technical abilities. But it's going to be exciting. All the names are going to be announced very shortly. So be sure to like us, hit us up, send us a DM. If you like this show, please share it. Please leave us a comment. Check us out on the podcast, Chicago Jazz Audio Experience. Just do a search. We're all over on every platform. You can catch up on back issues. And, of course, Chicago Music Revealed. .com. So until tomorrow, I'm digging this new time frame too. So I really appreciate everyone tuning in. Tomorrow, 6 p.m., we will be here with Wayne Powers and Brett Dean and a whole lot more. So everybody stay safe, everybody stay healthy. And as I always say, if you like this show, tell your neighbors, tell your family, call the grandkids. Chicago Music Revealed right here, 6 p.m. Central Standard Time. We'll see you tomorrow.